muffled groan. I pulled up his eyelids, but his eyes were rolled back into his head and he made no response. He was breathing normally, though, and I realized then that his trouble was not the choking clouds of smoke. He had been drugged. I rummaged in his pockets for one of his enormous scarlet handkerchiefs and took it to the washstand, wetting it and wringing it out before tying it loosely over his mouth and nose. I fixed my own dampened handkerchief about my face and took stock of our situation. I went to the window, but the room overlooked a short flight of stone steps. If I could maneuver Stoker to the window, I could do nothing more than shove him out. He would doubtless break his back on one of the stone treads. Neither could I climb out and leave him as I went for help. The fire would no doubt move too quickly for that. There was only one thing to be done. How, you may wonder, did I, a woman of diminutive inches and slender build, manage to rescue a man of Stoker's prodigious size from a burning building? Reader, I carried him. Chapter 13. With every bit of strength I possessed, I hauled Stoker onto my back, draping his torso over my own and letting his legs drag behind as we made our way down the stairs. I saw no one, heard no alarm, but I made no effort to see to Mrs. Giddens. The woman could be burnt to cinders for all I cared. I had no doubt the source of Stoker's indisposition had been something slipped into the turnip wine. Only my distaste for the stuff had kept me from suffering the same fate, unconsciousness and oblivion as fire raged around us. The front door was open, no doubt to facilitate Mrs. Giddens's flight, but I turned and went the opposite direction. The parlour was fully engulfed, and the smoke stung my eyes as the conflagration raged, hot tongues of flame lapping at Stoker's booted feet. With one last burst of effort, I reached the back of the house and opened the door, gulping in great heaving breaths of cold air. The sudden rush of it fed the fire, sending sparks heavenwards as I hauled Stoker down the short flight of stone steps and across the yard. It was the work of a moment to force open the door of the wash house and see him settled there. I yanked the handkerchief from his face and tore off my own, taking several deep, shuddering breaths before I crept out, rounding the side of the house, careful to keep to the shadows. I could hear the bells then, summoning the fire brigade, and from the glow of the inferno I could see Mrs. Giddens and Daisy huddled on the pavement amidst a consoling horde of neighbours. The fire brigade appeared, leather buckets in hand, fitting hoses and herding back the spectators. I could hear the chief of them asking Mrs. Giddens if everyone was out. She shook her head.
No, I have two guests in the Chinese bedroom in the front. I tried everything to wake them, but they must already have been overcome by the smoke.
She broke off, pressing her hands to her mouth and doing a very good impression of a woman in distress. My suspicions confirmed, I slipped back the way I had come. It took a good deal of effort and some rather nasty methods, but Stoker was eventually roused.
"What the devil is that smell?"
he demanded in a thick voice. "Burnt hair," I told him.
"Why did you burn your hair?"
"I didn't." I explained as briefly as I could. When I had finished, I settled myself next to a gap in the washhouse wall, keeping an eye upon the proceedings as Stoker slipped back into sleep. Now that I had satisfied myself that he had suffered no permanent damage from the sedative, the simplest course of action was to let him sleep it off. I certainly could carry him no further, and attempting to do so would only attract unwelcome attention. Far better to stay where we were, tucked securely away in a spot no one would think to look, and slip away in the morning. In due course, the fire brigade had finished its work, saving the structure, although the interior had been burnt to ash. Members of the brigade and neighbours milled about for some time, but the cold eventually drove them inside, and things grew quiet. I occupied myself with surveying the wash house. I had sat down hard upon something sharply pointed, and after a gingerly inspection, I discovered the culprit, a shard of pottery. It was terracotta, marked with a curious painted symbol in ochre. A careful hunt produced a single silver sequin and a tiny piece of some material I could not identify, but of a dazzling blue colour with a high sheen. I pocketed the little collection and settled myself again upon the packed earth floor. It would be an uncomfortable night, but by no means the worst I had known. We had left our coats behind, but by the expedient of huddling together, we retained sufficient body heat to pass the night in reasonable comfort. It was just getting on for 7 in the morning when Stoker roused himself, rubbing his eyes and putting a hand to his doubtless aching head.
"What in the name of bleeding Jesus happened?"
"What do you remember?" I asked, smoothing my hair into some semblance of order and neatening my disordered clothes.
"Precious little. I thought I saw a fire, and I had the oddest sensation of being carried."
"You were. I'm sorry to say you were drugged, no doubt in that vile turnip wine. Then our hostess appears to have set fire to the hotel, fully intending to roast us in our beds." Stoker swore then, something fluently profane, and I knew he was well on the way to recovery. "How well do you feel?" I asked.
"Well enough to get the hell out of here and back to London,"
he said with some feeling. He glanced around, taking in our surroundings.
"Not that I am entirely certain of where here is," he temporized.
As soon as he was capable of standing, I used our dampened handkerchiefs to wipe the soot from our faces, and we slid out of the wash house. "A handy wash house in the yard of the Victoria Hotel," I informed him. "I thought it best to let you sleep off the effects of the drug, and we have no coats. A wash house was the warmest solution I could devise."
"Or a police station?"
he suggested.
"It is not beyond the realm of possibility that we could inform the authorities of Mrs. Giddens's murderous ways, Veronica."
"Out of the question," I told him in a brisk voice. "Let her worry when the fire brigade do not find a pair of nicely crisped corpses."
"But..."
I held up a hand. "Stoker, you are in no fit state to argue. Now, I have little doubt we could have eventually prevailed upon the Dover police to believe us, but at what price? We are an unmarried couple, masquerading as a lord and his wife, no doubt bent upon the purposes of prurient exercise. At least, that is what they will assume. And that is the best of what they might assume about us. Do not forget, you are implicated in the possible murder of a man who disappeared from the very hotel where we stayed. Does that not seem the slightest bit suspicious to you?" He gave me an unhappy look.
"Well, if you put it that way..."
"I do." I rose and put out a hand. "Now let us be off." We arrived at the train station just as the first train was preparing to depart. If our wrinkled clothes and lack of appropriate outer garments raised questions, no one was rude enough to voice them directly. In a few hours' time, we were back in London and settled at the Belvedere, washed, dressed, and demolishing the most enormous breakfast cook could provide. The dangers through which we had passed added spice to our repast. Were eggs ever so fresh, toast ever so crisp, ham ever so sweet? I had just helped myself to a second plate. Stoker was on his third, his appetite suffering nothing from his ordeal, when George appeared, the latest copy of the Daily Harbinger tucked under his arm.
"Good morning, miss, Mr. Stoker,"
he said, proffering the newspaper in exchange for a piece of bacon. I turned to the newspaper, preparing myself for the worst. No doubt J.J. Butterworth had embellished the tales of Stoker's misdeeds to egregious new depths. George took a second piece of bacon, tearing it into bits for the dogs.
"I was sorry to hear about your brother, sir," he said to Stoker.
Stoker looked up from his eggs.
"What about him? And which one?"
he asked. But even before I looked at the newspaper, I knew.
Oh, I said faintly. I turned the newspaper so that the headline faced Stoker. Viscount feared dead with mistress in Dover fire.
Bloody bollocking hell, he said, dropping his fork.
Exactly, I replied.
The fact that Tiberius, Viscount Templeton Vane, waited until after breakfast to pay a call was indicative of his native courtesy. He did not bother to announce himself at the main door of Bishop's Folly, but proceeded directly to the Belvedere and entered without knocking. He was, as ever, beautifully dressed, with a knack for elegant tailoring that Stoker would never achieve. They were of a similar height and build, although his lordship was several years the senior, and their features were strongly marked by nature in the same mould. As they were half-brothers, their colouring varied. Stoker's hair was black as only the base-born son of a Welshman's can be, and his eyes rather violently blue. His lordship was somewhat less arresting on first sight, with brown eyes and hair, but it took only a brief second glance to appreciate the silken wave of his locks and the mischievous gleam in the depths of those smoke-dark eyes. The mischief was not in evidence this morning. The Viscount wore instead an expression of nearly implacable fury, damped down to a finely honed coldness that was perfectly calibrated to the situation at hand.
Miss Speedwell, Revelstoke,
he said by way of greeting. He did not remove his gloves or his hat, a clear indication that he meant this to be a call of the most formal variety.
My lord, I said, rising from the remains of the meal we had just finished. I am afraid you have caught us over a late breakfast. Might I offer you some tea?
He held up a hand.
I require nothing, my dear Miss Speedwell, except an explanation.
His gaze fell to the newspaper upon the table. With a thin, cold smile, he seated himself upon the camel saddle we kept for visitors, and looked from me to his brother expectantly. Stoker sighed.
The fault is mine,
he began.
I have no doubt of that,
the Viscount replied.
I stepped forwards. Now, see here, that is not entirely true. I am just as involved in this investigation as you are.
Ah.
His lordship raised a brow into a perfectly pointed Gothic arch.
One of your little investigations, I might have guessed.
We were pursuing a line of inquiry in Dover, and it became necessary to check into an hotel. Naturally, we could not use our own names, I told him. Think of the scandal if we registered as an unmarried couple. His lordship opened his mouth, but it was my turn to cut him off. I promise you that nothing happened, apart from the proprietress trying to murder us.
His handsome mouth went slack in genuine astonishment.
Is this true? Your lives were in danger?
Yes,
Stoker said quietly.
I'd have been burnt to ash if Veronica hadn't awoken.
The Viscount's brow winged upwards again.
Indeed.
I sighed. We shared a room, but I can assure you that no one's honour was compromised. His expression turned mocking.
Shall I demand that you make an honest man of my brother?
There is no call for that, I promised him. He was a perfect gentleman in every regard.
A slow smile spread over the Viscount's features as his eyes met mine.
I always said he was a fool,
he said softly. I grinned, and Stoker cleared his throat.
Pardon me for pointing it out, but I thought you were here to castigate us. If you mean to rant, do it and get out. I have things to do.
The Viscount held my gaze a moment longer, then looked, reluctantly, it seemed, to his brother.
Very well, I am a man of the world, Revelstoke. Your little peccadillo is hardly going to harm my reputation. I am glad the pair of you escaped harm. How did you escape harm?
He asked. Stoker flushed a little.
Miss Speedwell carried me.
His lordship's mouth twitched, but he shook his head.
No, I will not laugh at it, but I vow I will enjoy the thought of it for the rest of my life.
He turned to me.
I congratulate you, Miss Speedwell, on your presence of mind as well as your coolness in a crisis.
I acknowledged the compliment with a gracious inclination of the head.
For God's sake, Stoker muttered.
The Viscount looked from Stoker to me.
I think, as you have taken my name in vain, I might at least know what you are about.
I saw no point in prevarication, so I pointed to the newspaper. The Tiverton story. The disappearance of John de Morgan. He raised his brows suggestively.
Indeed. I should have thought you would be first on the list of possible suspects, Revelstoke. Thank you for the vote of confidence,
Stoker returned with equal hauteur.
Although,
his lordship went on,
I would expect rather less theatrical window dressing if you were involved. A nice clean beating or a knife to the throat. Those would be far more your style.
Stoker rolled his eyes heavenwards, but refused to rise to the bait. I turned to the Viscount. Do you know the Tivertons? I inquired.
I have not had the doubtful pleasure of making their acquaintance.
Doubtful? He shrugged.
Sir Leicester is an excitable little monkey of a man, although I hear his second wife is unobjectionable and his first wife was an absolute paragon.
From whom have you heard that?
From one of her most devoted admirers,
he informed us.
Horace Steele. You know Horace Steele?
Stoker demanded.
My dear fellow, I do have a social life, and it does occasionally include befriending Americans. I'm considered eccentric for it. We share an interest in art and have on occasion crossed swords at the auction houses. Ours is a casual connection, nothing more.
What can you tell us about him? The Viscount stroked his chin thoughtfully.
He outbid me at an auction for a charming little fragonard. I have never forgiven him, although we do occasionally meet for dinner. He is devilishly shrewd. Oddly, he is also frightfully romantic, a sentimentalist, and you know I have no time for such things.
Are you so unmoved by sentiment? I asked.
Sentiment is for children. And Horace Steele is nothing so much as an overgrown child when it comes to matters of the heart. And you, of course, are entirely lacking in such an organ,
Stoker said nastily. The Viscount clucked his tongue.
If that was meant to be an insult, you will have to try harder, dear fellow. I pride myself on my detachment. Save where my interests are stirred,
he added with a significant look at me.
But if you are inquiring about his character, I have found him trustworthy. Once or twice he has put me in the way of a piece he knew I particularly wanted, and might have bid for himself.
You do not think him underhanded?
No more so than any other successful man. And probably a good deal less.
His lordship rose smoothly.
Well, I have satisfied myself that you are both in good health. I will send a telegram to the Dover police informing them that I am alive and well in London, and completely mystified as to who might have been masquerading as me.
Stoker gave him a grudging nod.
Thank you, Tiberius. That is uncommonly decent of you.
The Viscount bowed over my hand.
I am an uncommonly decent fellow.
He rose and bent to my ear, his lips very nearly brushing my skin.
Although I should like more than ever to be indecent with you, my dear Miss Speedwell.
He murmured, just loudly enough for me to hear. Before I could reply, he stepped back and raised his voice.
How are your little Lunas faring?
Very well. They should emerge from the cocoons any day now. Would you like me to let you know when they have eclosed? You should get to see them fly, after all.
I would be delighted.
He turned to go, then paused and turned back almost as an afterthought.
Oh, and while I deplore the habit of keeping score amongst one's friends and relations, I think it best if the pair of you remember how very accommodating I have been under the circumstances.
Stoker gave him a baleful look.
Meaning?
The Viscount smiled, baring strong white teeth in a wolfish smile.
Meaning that one of these days I might well have circumstances of my own which require your accommodation. I shall expect to be able to call in this favour.
Stoker opened his mouth, no doubt to say something entirely rude, but I forestalled him. We shall be at your disposal, my lord.
I am counting upon it, Miss Speedwell. Why on earth did you promise him that we would help him?
Stoker demanded when he had gone. I shrugged. I like him. Stoker gave me a narrow look.
Of course you do. He's handsome and charming and a lord.
Those are the least interesting of his qualities, I told him. His lordship is also complicated and unpredictable, with some very intriguing hobbies.
I give up,
Stoker told me. We applied ourselves to our work then, Stoker making good progress on his platypus, and my gonorilla at last being revealed in all her exquisite nudity. We had just finished when the afternoon edition of the newspaper was delivered. I was not surprised to find my world once again upended by the headline. It had become so common an occurrence that I would have been shocked if J.J. Butterworth had found anything else to write about. Mummy's Curse Strikes Again. Stoker glimpsed the headline over my shoulder.
What fresh deviltry has happened now?
He demanded. I showed him the article, a lurid piece about the sightings of Anubis in the city.
Which brings us back to the question, who is playing Anubis? And do not start with any more of that nonsense about spectral visitations,
he warned. I pulled a face. I told you I was merely entertaining possibilities. Think of it as an intellectual exercise. In this case, I quite agree with you that Occam's razor is appropriate. The simplest explanation is the likeliest.
And the simplest explanation is that someone connected with the Tiverton case is going around haunting people in the guise of Anubis.
More than one Anubis, thanks to his appearance at the Sudbury, I reminded him. But it is most logical to take them one at a time. The figure, whoever he might be, has appeared in Egypt, here in Marylebone, and in the Strand. Now to suspects. The form was undoubtedly male, which lets out Lady Tiverton and Figgy. We are left with Horace and Henry Steele, Patrick Fairbrother, and Sir Leicester Tiverton as the most obvious choices. Stoker snorted.
Steele the younger and Fairbrother, I will grant you. But Sir Leicester and Horace Steele, they are aged.
I primmed my mouth. I think you will concede my expertise on the subject of the male form, I said sedately. I can assure you that while both of those gentlemen are of advancing years, they would both strip admirably. Like our Anubis, Sir Leicester has broad shoulders, and if you took away Mr. Steele's lavish white hair and moustaches, you would find him significantly younger than you think. He moves with a certain allure, I finished, thinking pleasurably on his silken moustaches upon my fingers. Stoker snapped his fingers in front of my face.
If you can tear yourself away from your salacious wool-gathering, I would like to point out that you have forgot another man who deserves to be a suspect.
Oh? Stoker paused, clearly relishing the moment.
First, the reporter for the Daily Harbinger. The fellow is making a name for himself out of all this drivel. It seems at least possible that he is behind some of the more outlandish aspects.
I nodded. Well done, I acknowledged. That is certainly plausible. And I have one more name to add to the list of possible villains. He quirked up a brow in inquiry, but I held the moment, heightening the anticipation.
Well?
He demanded.
Who else might be wearing the guise of Anubis?
The man who began it all, I told him. John de Morgan himself. Chapter 14. We argued for the better part of an hour.
You cannot be serious,
he said more than once. As the grave, I replied. All we know for certain is that de Morgan disappeared. We do not know where he is at present, nor do we know what has become of him.
I think it is bloody well obvious he met with foul play in that hole of a hotel,
he returned hotly.
The changes to the room prove that.
The changes to the room are theatrical window dressing. What was the point of them? To confuse and upset Caroline de Morgan, or to give the appearance of upsetting her, I added as an afterthought.
You still think she might be in league with John?
He said sharply. I think it possible. She has been clever and devious enough to pretend she is having a mental collapse in order to avoid more questions by the police investigators. Consider, she left Egypt with her husband and turned up in Dover, hysterically claiming he has vanished. Has she been detained? Arrested for his murder? No. She has simply been handed over to the care of her parents. In time, she will be forgot. And what then? With no body and no evidence against her, she will fade from notoriety. She can go where she likes, perhaps to meet up with him, perhaps to sell the jewel herself if she has betrayed him. He looked at me for a long, inscrutable moment.
You are as good as accusing her of her husband's murder. At the very least, you think her capable of conspiring with him. At worst, you think her a potential murderess.
A potential murderess carrying a child, I said thoughtfully. That does complicate matters, but that diadem would go a very long way towards supporting her and her infant if she made her escape from England. He said nothing more. I turned to the rest of the post, leaving him with his thoughts. There was the usual assortment of bills and circulars, letters and journals, and I collected everything in a basket to sort later. I took supper alone in my Gothic chapel, relishing my solitude. Once I had eaten, I went to the Roman temple where his lordship had installed the latest accomplishments in the plumbing arts. The wash in my own facilities had been insufficient after our Dover adventures, I decided. I needed a proper scrubbing from head to toe and all the attendant relaxation. In the temple were three plunge pools of varying temperatures, as well as a soaking tub and a shower bath, the last of which I made full use of in order to scrub myself free of the lingering traces of soot. I returned to my little Gothic chapel to smoke and think over the case. I had supplemented my wardrobe with bits and pieces from the collection in the Belvedere, and my current dressing gown was a rather splendid and tattered robe from the Chinese Imperial Opera. It was scarlet silk, heavily fringed and embroidered, and I wore it belted at the waist, my hair loose as I sat before the fire to dry it. Fatigued from our adventures in Dover, I slept, waking far later the next morning than was my custom. Still dressed in my robe of China silk, I perused the rest of the post as I brushed my hair, sorting the letters and bills from the periodicals. At length, all that remained was the parcel I had noted the day before our departure, plainly wrapped and lacking a postmark. I tossed the brown wrapping paper aside to find a pasteboard box of the most common variety. Within it, nestled carefully on a bed of excelsior, was another box, this one of brass, worked with Egyptian motifs. I turned it over, but could find no significant markings, no note to identify the sender. With a sigh, I put it aside and thrust my feet into slippers. Stoker was still sunk deeply into sleep, sprawled over the width of his bed like a starfish. His coverlet had slipped to his hips, revealing chest and belly, both admirably muscled, moulded by the benevolent hand of nature into a form so alluring it would have given Michelangelo pause to sculpt it. I poked one delectable shoulder. He growled and put a pillow over his head.
"Go away."
"There has been a development in the case," I told him.
"I don't care if Queen Victoria herself has confessed to killing John de Morgan in Trafalgar Square. I need sleep."
"You need to get out of that bed," I countered. He growled again, and I reached for the coverlet, twitching it down another 6 inches to bare his iliac furrows. With a howl of outraged modesty, he bolted to a sitting position, hauling the coverlet up to his collarbone.
"Veronica, have some decency. You very nearly exposed my...
"Yes, I have seen your before, if you will recall, and you've nothing to be shy about. It's quite impressive." He blushed furiously and yanked the coverlet up until only his eyebrows were visible.
"My is mine to show when I wish, not for your prurient gawping when it suits you. What do you want?"
"I want you to come to my pavilion. I have something to show you. Whether you come naked or not is entirely your affair," I told him. I hurried back to my pavilion to dress. The thin China silk robe was little comfort against the February chill, and stoked up the fire. Stoker was 5 minutes behind, still buttoning his shirt when he arrived.
"This bloody well better be worth it," he rasped.
I handed him the box. "From an anonymous party." He scrutinized it carefully.
"And you think it contains a threat?"
"Remember what happened the last time we received an anonymous box in the post?" I prodded. He grinned. During our previous investigation, we had received a clue in the form of a body part that had been carelessly left in the Belvedere until one of the dogs ate it. Stoker was many things, but stupid he was not. He turned the box away from us and opened it from behind. As soon as the lid was opened, a cobra sprang out, launching some 6 or 7 feet across the room before coming to rest on my bed. It fell behind, landing with a thud upon the floor. Together we flattened ourselves, peering under the bed. "It isn't moving," I told him. "Do you think it died from inanition whilst confined in the box?" He took a closer look, then dove under the bed, emerging with the serpent clasped in one fist.
"It didn't die because it was never alive. It was knit," he told me, tossing the thing in an easy arc.
I caught it reflexively. The surface was cheap wool, rough and inelegant. Nothing like the smooth warmth of an actual snakeskin. "Shabby thing, isn't he?" Stoker pointed to the embellishment of the hood and a peculiar dark mark upon the face.
"It's got the teardrop marking under the eye. Someone went to a good deal of trouble to make us think, at least for an instant, that it was real.
Pity they wasted the effort. I presume you have seen the thing in the wild?
And mounted dozens. Every army man who serves in the East brings one of the beastly things home. But they have often been badly done, and I have to take them apart and rebuild them.
He cocked his head curiously.
Where did you become acquainted with them?
A particularly memorable interlude at a marketplace in Madagascar. It is an incident I do not recall with especial fondness. I told him, where do we think this fellow came from?
I presume you have examined the wrappings?
No postmark. It was with the rest of the letters the day before yesterday.
Which delivery?
He asked, narrowing his eyes. The one that was sitting on my desk when Figgy Tiverton was here, I said, keeping my voice carefully neutral. I needn't have bothered. He did not trouble to mask his outrage.
Of all the vile insinuations, that shy and delightful girl,
he began. You only think she is delightful because she worships you, I countered.
She most certainly does not,
he cut in sharply. I held up a hand. I am too fatigued for false modesty, Stoker. You have a peculiar effect upon the fair sex, we may agree upon that, and Miss Tiverton is merely the latest in a long line of females who have succumbed to your charms. He was not mollified.
There is no possible way that Figgy Tiverton is responsible for that,
he said, pointing to the woolen snake in my hand. He brandished the box at me.
There is a spring in here to launch the thing at an unsuspecting recipient. It has fangs. It was designed to provoke a response of sheer terror.
We fell silent. Then Stoker raised a point that had not occurred to me.
The box was delivered the day before we went to Dover,
he began.
It was intended as a threat of some sort.
It failed spectacularly, I replied with some relish.
But only because you have the sensitivity of a Russian boar,
he pointed out.
Most women would have fainted or flailed at such a thing.
I opened my mouth, but he held up a quelling hand.
I know. You are not most women. It was intended as a compliment.
I sat a little straighter. But why was it directed to me? You are engaged in the investigation as well. Why not put both our names on the parcel? Stoker gave me an inscrutable look.
Because whoever sent it, and I do not concede for a moment that it was Miss Tiverton, expected hysterics. No doubt with an eye to encouraging you to drop the investigation.
How very curious. You wouldn't drop the investigation for such a silly reason. Why should I?
Most people are incapable of understanding a woman like you,
he said simply.
You defy comprehension.
That might be the nicest thing you have ever said to me. Being brushed with the black wings of death had done wonders for his temper. He was still prone to lapsing into silence, but his natural vitality had begun to assert itself once more.
The timing raises another point, he went on. If the box was intended as a warning and we did not heed it, then whoever wants us to leave John de Morgan in peace might attempt more drastic measures.
He removed the box from my hand.
Therefore, we must take the battle to them.
Them? To whom? We don't know our enemy, I pointed out. He shrugged.
Our movements are being observed, at least upon occasion. Otherwise our little adventure in Dover would never have happened.
You think it was a deliberate attempt on our lives? And not a spontaneous act born of desperation?
Unlikely. It might have been purest coincidence that the hotel just happened to burn down the night we were there, but I don't like coincidences. I suspect the proprietress was put wise to our investigation and instructed to eliminate the evidence of John de Morgan's disappearance.
The fact that we were there at the same time would have been two very tidy birds slain with a single stone. No corroboration for Caroline's story, and no meddlesome sleuths determined to ask uncomfortable questions.
I nodded. And somehow I do not like Mrs. Giddens for a mastermind. She is clearly answerable to someone, but whom?
That is what we need to discover. Go and put on a hat, he instructed. We are bound for the Sudbury.
I am seldom inclined to do as I am told, but with Stoker's decisiveness came a resurgence of both his energy and his resolve, and I gave way with good grace, buttoning on my black astrakhan coat. My spirits were even more buoyed by the addition of a new hat, a fetching beaver top hat embellished with a cluster of lush red velvet roses and a length of black veiling tucked atop the rolled brim. The day was fine, at least as fine as may be expected in the killing fogs of February, and as we set off for the Sudbury, even Stoker seemed jaunty. He wore his eye patch, and his normally tumbled locks were even more wind-blown than usual. He made no effort to subdue them, but merely clapped on a low, slouching hat purchased off a gaucho in the Argentine. The wide brim shadowed his face, giving him a menacing air, and as he enjoyed nothing better than frightening the timid, he set a brisk pace as we walked. We arrived at the Sudbury in good order. Julien Dorland was presiding over the first service of the luncheon hour, supervising the appearance of every tray before it was carried up to the waiting guests. He adjusted a bit of crystallized mint on a plate of ices, nodding as if bestowing a benediction. He gestured for us to wait in his office, and joined us as soon as he was able, flicking an invisible bit of lint from his immaculate coat as he did so.
"Hello, my friends. Please make yourselves comfortable. I have arranged for some refreshments,"
he said, ushering in one of his staff, who carried a tray laden with tiny glasses of sharp blackberry cordial, and another with a plate of tiny tarts shaped like catrefoils and filled with sweetened almond-scented cream and topped with candied cherries. Stoker sighed in rapture as he sank his teeth into the pastry. Then he gave a frankly indecent moan while I looked inquiringly to Monsieur Durland. "We have come about the Tivitans," I began.
"Mademoiselle Speedwell," he said in a tone of lamentation. "What am I to do with you? I am an artiste, and yet you think only of business."
His expression was gently chiding, and he nodded once towards the pastry before me.
"Eat that, savor it, and then we will talk."
I did as he bade me, letting the crisp pastry melt on my tongue. He watched me narrowly, assessing my enjoyment of his arts, and I made the appropriate noises of appreciation. When I had swallowed the last delectable crumb, I settled back in my chair, folding my hands on my lap for good measure. Julien threw his head back and laughed.
"Like a schoolgirl. But you liked it?"
"It was heaven," I told him. Stoker nodded emphatically, his cheeks bulging with cream. Julien accepted the praise as no more than his due.
"I have worked for 15 years to perfect that recipe. It is not yet what it can be, but it is better than it was."
"Will it ever be perfect?" I wondered.
"No,"
he told me with a smile.
"Nothing in life is. But, my dear mademoiselle, life is not about achievement. It is about the effort. If one takes pleasure in every step, one enjoys the whole journey."
His eyes were twinkling, and I realized he might well be the most contented person of my acquaintance.
"You wish to know about the Tivertons,"
he said, pulling a face.
"They are dull beyond belief. Typically English. Milk puddings and boiled chickens."
He glanced at the window overlooking his domain and flicked a finger. Instantly, a subordinate appeared, his attitude one of reverence as he approached the master. Julien gave him a careless look.
"Ask Mademoiselle Berdy to come."
The fellow bobbed a head and vanished, reappearing almost instantaneously with a tiny, buxom brunette, whose lavish curves were barely confined by the crisp lines of her chambermaid's uniform. Her curls were covered by a starched white cap, but they threatened to escape, and her lips were a trifle too pink to owe their color to nature rather than art. She was a luscious-looking girl, but she had eyes only for the pastry chef.
"Monsieur Dorland?"
she asked breathlessly. He introduced us briefly.
"Miss Speedwell, Mr. Templeton Vane, this is Berdy, the chambermaid who attends the Tivertons. Berdy, you will speak frankly to Miss Speedwell and Mr. Templeton Vane,"
he instructed.
"Whatever questions they put to you, you will answer."
She nodded, her eyes round and bright with the devotion of an acolyte.
"Oh, yes, monsieur."
"Good girl,"
he said, his voice practically a purr.
"Now, I regret to say that Mademoiselle Tiverton has resisted the charms of my pastries. She does not send her compliments, no matter what delicacies I prepare. I have learnt nothing."
I felt a rush of disappointment, which must have been visible, for he lifted a quelling finger.
"But I have perfect faith in Mademoiselle Berdy. My little Choiseul, you have watched the Tiverton girl for me. What have you discovered?"
Berdy was eager to tell.
"She's bored silly, monsieur. Those parents of hers keep her on a short leash, they do. She doesn't go to shops or entertainments. She keeps to her room reading her books, always sensational novels like Rider Haggard's."
Monsieur Durland spread his hands in a thoroughly Gallic gesture.
"If she wants adventure, I would recommend to her Dumas, but that is neither here nor there." "Does she have visitors?"
Stoker asked. The girl gave him a lingering look, paying homage to his attractions, but in the end she shrugged. Her attention was firmly fixed upon Julien.
"Who would visit the little Tiverton? She is bored, I tell you. She goes out to walk the dog, and that is all. No callers, no going to the shops or entertainments. She talks to me sometimes, but I don't like to tell her about my life."
"Why not?" I asked. Berdy tipped her head.
"It sounds peculiar to say I feel sorry for her, miss, but I do. That father of hers is supposed to be so rich and high and mighty, but what good does it do her? I have three sisters, and I have a laugh with every one of them. I go to the museums on my day off, or the shops. I have friends and interests and a proper life. What does she have besides her dreary books and her dull papier-mâché?"
Stoker and I looked at one another, and a smile of sheer delight spread over his features.
"Did you say papier-mâché?"
She glanced at Julien, who nodded his encouragement.
"Yes, sir. Although why that should interest anyone, I cannot imagine. It is a pastime for children. But she is always asking me for newspaper, and there the poor girl sits in her room, making fruits and vegetables and ghastly heads out of whatever I can find her. It is most peculiar."
"On the contrary," I told her, "it is the most interesting thing in the world right now."
"I'm sure I don't know why,"
she began, but Julien lifted a brow.
"My little flower, who are we to judge the pleasures of others? We are responsible only for our own,"
he murmured. She gave a breathy little sigh, and I flicked a glance to Stoker, who shrugged.
"Is there anything else you can tell us about the Tibetans?"
he asked the girl. She tipped her head, putting the tip of her tongue between her teeth as she thought.
"Nothing that comes to mind, sir."
"Very well,"
If you think of anything else, you'll be sure to tell Monsieur d'Orland directly, yes?
She beamed ecstatically at Julien.
Of course.
She sketched a brief curtsy in our direction as Julien rose to walk her to the door.
You've done very well, my dove. Perhaps later you will come back, and I will make for you a religieuse,
he promised.
Oh, what is that?
She asked, eyes wide with anticipation.
It is the French word for nun,
he told her.
But we will speak no more of chastity.
She gave a low giggle, and he closed the door behind her, turning back to us as he smoothed the velvet of his cap. I suppressed a smile, but Stoker looked at him reproachfully.
She is half your age,
he pointed out. Julien d'Orland lifted his hands in a perfectly Gallic gesture.
Who am I to quibble with the demands of Venus? Mercury, more like, if you aren't careful,
Stoker muttered.
Stoker, I said sharply. Kindly do not make reference to the treatment of venereal diseases in polite company.
I wouldn't exactly call Julien polite,
he protested, but he said nothing more. I rose and gave Julien my hand. Forgive him. He's been out of sorts lately. Julien's handsome mouth curved into a conspiratorial smile.
Really? How can you tell?
We shared a laugh as Stoker regarded us sourly. Julien bent over my hand.
Ah, this sweet blossom of a hand. How I hate to relinquish it,
he said, stroking it gently.
Relinquish it, or swallow your own teeth,
Stoker told him in a pleasant tone, laced with steel. Julien shook his head.
Mademoiselle, does he often threaten violence in your gentle presence?
More than you would expect, I told him, and he has even, upon one notable occasion, stabbed me. But since I am responsible for his being shot a few months ago, I am inclined to overlook his moods. Julien straightened, clearly startled as he turned to Stoker.
You stabbed her?
He demanded. Stoker looked mightily affronted.
Not deliberately. I would only ever stab Veronica by accident.
Quite, I said, giving him a fond smile. You are, for all your sins, Stoker, a gentleman. We bade a befuddled Julien farewell and made our way through the Sudbury kitchens, emerging onto the pavement.
I do wish you wouldn't tell people I stabbed you,
Stoker protested.
But you did, I pointed out. I still have the scar.
You bloody well do not. I stitched you up more prettily than the Bayeux tapestry. Furthermore,
he was just warming to his theme when I stopped him with a hand to his chest. I may have applied rather more force than I intended, for he rocked backwards, stumbling into a coal hauler, and it was some several seconds before he disentangled himself and brushed off the coal dust.
Veronica, what the devil are you about?
He demanded. I grabbed his hand and towed him towards the corner, taking the precaution of pausing to peep around the building before emerging into view.
Look there,
I instructed, jerking my chin. Some little distance ahead, Figgy Tiverton was walking Newt.
So, we know the girl walks the dog,
he said, in some irritation as he excavated a lump of coal from his pocket.
Look at who Figgy is following,
I ordered. 40 or 50 yards ahead of Figgy walked a slender figure with a graceful, distinctive step.
Lady Tiverton,
Stoker said softly, catching the scent of an intrigue.
Exactly. Now, why would young Figgy follow her stepmother without making her presence known?
Without bothering to wait for a reply, I moved to follow Figgy. Stoker's hand clamped to my arm stayed me.
What do you mean to do?
Trail them, of course. I glanced at him, all 6 feet of distinctly male Revelstoke Templeton Vane. He was dressed conventionally enough, in a town suit and proper shoes, rather than his usual breeches and boots. But his hair was long, his hat was bohemian, and his ears glinted with the gold of the loops threaded through each lobe. He looked like nothing so much as an Elizabethan privateer, and he would certainly attract attention just when we needed to be unremarkable. I pointed this out, to which he made a few rather sharp and somewhat nasty observations of his own. I believe the phrase Roman prostitute was bandied about with regard to my hat. And then I pulled down the veil on my hat, covering my face. Stay here, I hissed, without bothering to wait for the inevitable protest. I slipped into the stream of foot traffic upon the Strand, following Figgy following her stepmother. It was easy enough to keep the child in view. She wore a sailor hat with a particularly lurid shade of yellow for the bow, and Newt kept darting in and out of the pedestrians, causing a bit of jolly havoc wherever she went. Ahead of us, Lady Tiverton walked with purpose, looking neither left nor right. We followed her as she crossed a street, Newt nearly expiring under the hooves of a passing tram team, and turned several corners before her ladyship reached her destination. She entered a narrow stone building with a jaunty blue-striped awning. Figgy hesitated when she came to the building, then continued on, looking behind her once or twice with a doubtful expression. I darted into a bookshop, browsing the volumes in the window as I kept a weather eye upon the street. After several minutes, Lady Tiverton emerged, carrying a parcel marked with the name of the business, Caswell & Co. Linen Drapers. I counted to 30 before stepping from the bookshop, but I needn't have bothered. I had assumed Figgy had carried on down the street, but this was a miscalculation. Just as I stepped from the bookshop, she passed, so close I nearly trod on Newt's paw. But the dog paid me no attention. Instead, she was straining at the lead, whining and lunging until the slim bit of leather slipped from Figgy's hands. Without warning, the dog dashed across the street, narrowly avoiding a streetcar and launching herself into the air. At the last moment, Stoker caught her, holding her at arm's length as she squirmed in delight, lavishing licks to his face. Figgy, with a cry of alarm, followed. I was not near enough to hear what Stoker said, but he must have spun her some tale, for she let him take Newt's lead in hand, setting the dog carefully onto her feet again. With great courtesy, Stoker offered his arm, and the girl took it, her blush apparent from across the street. They turned in the direction of the Sudbury, and I watched them go in frank irritation, until I saw Stoker take his lead hand and flick a sign at me behind his back. It was a brisk gesture in the direction of the blue awning, and I understood instantly what he intended. I entered the shop and waited to be attended to. A few minutes' skillful conversation extracted the information I wanted. By way of showing my appreciation, I made a purchase of my own from the clerk and returned to the Sudbury to collect Stoker. He fell into step with me as I passed the hotel.
"What did you learn?"
he asked softly, as we made our way to the Folly. "Nothing of real importance, and this case begins to task me. I am in need of physical exertion to clear my mental processes," I told him. I made my way directly to the Roman temple where the plunge pool was located. Stoker was polite enough to wait until I had stripped off my clothes and paddled vigorously for some minutes before presenting himself. Too small for proper exercise, the plunge pool nonetheless provided an excellent opportunity for exercising the limbs, and I was rather deliciously invigorated by the time I emerged. With enormous delicacy, Stoker kept his back to me until I had wrapped myself in a Turkish robe I had left hanging in the bathhouse. Although mindful of my modesty, of which I had none, but it was sweet of him to think so, in contrast to his earlier mood, Stoker was perfectly heedless of his. He dropped his clothing with the nonchalance